You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Criminal defense lawyer Lisa Peebles was taken aback by a secretly recorded phone call and police interrogation video that surfaced in a 20-year-old kidnapping case. They held the stench of a cover-up. She recruited an investigative reporter to help unearth the truth and exonerate Gary Thibodeau, the man convicted in the 1994 kidnapping and murder of 18-year-old Heidi Allen. Scrapped, justice and a teen informant exposes the underbelly of a system built more for finality than justice. It's the true story of Peebles' pursuit of new evidence against three new suspects and her discovery that Heidi had lived a double life, convenience store cashier and undercover informant. The sheriff's office hid the truth about her death as the real killers roam free. Peebles became a de facto prosecutor to prove their guilt and Gary's innocence. As Heidi's family stood by the sheriff, her remains were likely secreted right under their noses, probably inside a scrap van and shipped to a car shredder in Canada. The book that we're featuring this evening is Scrapped, Justice and a Team Informant, with my special guests, Lisa Peebles and John O'Brien. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Lisa Peebles and John O'Brien.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for having us, Dan. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. This is an incredible story. As I mentioned, this is extraordinary. Let's get right to your background, Lisa, and before we talk about your background, John, just for our audience to understand who you were before this incredible April 3rd, 1994 event. Lisa?
Sure. Yeah, I'm the federal public defender for the Northern District of New York. I've been working in this office in the capacity as a defense attorney for 22 years. When Gary's case was brought to my attention, a colleague of mine had been in private practice, and she had been representing him when new evidence surfaced. By that time, I was the head of the office, so that's when we started exploring avenues to pursue on behalf of Gary when that new evidence came to our attention. I sit in Syracuse, New York, and the case involving the kidnapping of Heidi Allen happened in Oswego County, which is about 45 minutes from Syracuse. In the Oswego County is located within the Northern District of New York, which is part of the territory that our office covers.
Mm-hmm. Your background, John?
Yeah, so I was a reporter for the newspaper in Syracuse for 30 years. Last 10 years I was there, I was an investigative reporter, and one of the things I covered was federal court. So I would often harass Lisa whenever I saw her and said, "Hey, you got any stories for me?" And she was very friendly and nice, but she often said no. And but then one day she said, "Hey, I have something brewing that you're definitely going to want to know about." And it took months for me to finally get it out of her about this new evidence in the Heidi Allen case, which was a very big case in not just Oswego County, but all of Central New York for years. So,
tell us, John, about Easter Sunday morning, April 3rd, 1994, and the D&W convenience store and a person at that store flagging down a passing deputy. Take us back.
So Heidi Allen was an 18-year-old cashier who worked at the D&W. And Easter morning, customers came in and realized that they were trying to buy their paper or whatever items they were buying. Really, there was no clerk there. And they looked around the store, and one man realized that there might be a problem. They saw her keys on the Connor, I believe, and then he went outside and flagged down a passing sheriff's deputy who came in and then looked again for the cashier, for Heidi, and couldn't find her. And that's when they realized something untoward may have happened.
Now, how did police proceed with this? And you say they already had somebody flag down a deputy. So how did police proceed with finding out what had happened to this woman?
Well, they pretty quickly cordoned off the area as a possible crime scene. And then they began a search. Within an hour and a half, they started searching in the area, and the search grew as people in the area found out. Her family was told that she's missing. They got involved. They quickly, the family did, put up missing posters for Heidi. The sheriff's office got search teams together and found no sign of her. Her car was left there in the parking lot, and it looked like something must have happened to her. The sheriff's office that day was contacted by the New York State Police, which has a lot more resources available and more experienced investigators. The sheriff himself, Charles Nellis, told the state police, "We got this. We're handling it." So the state police backed off and did not get involved. But one thing the sheriff's office did not do, which most police departments would do, and just makes common sense, they did not set up roadblocks anywhere that first day. So it was kind of odd.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now, Lisa, how did what did police think they discovered, or what did they discover, and then where was their investigation leading in terms of suspects almost immediately?
Initially, they did notice a tread mark near the front entrance of the store. So they did take an imprint of the tread mark. But aside from that, there was no real evidence to even suggest that that Heidi had been forcibly taken. Her keys were on the counter along with her purse. And as John mentioned, her car was in the parking lot. So they didn't have a whole lot to go on. They set up a command center early on, and the missing posters, as John suggested. The family knew she wouldn't have run off because she had a close relationship with a boyfriend who had been with her earlier that morning at the store with her. She had plans to meet up with his family for Easter dinner. So they knew right away that, something, like John mentioned, sinister must have happened, or something was definitely wrong. But early on, they had zero leads. They were really just scrambling, trying to figure out what could have happened to her as far as the sheriff's department was concerned. When they actually started kind of targeting Richard Thibodeau, he was a gentleman who had gone into the store and made the last purchase. But at the time, they didn't know who made the last purchase. They saw a purchase of two packs of cigarettes on the register at 7:42. That was the time that was on the register tape. So they knew the time of the last purchase. They had the tread mark in front of the store, and they had an individual who had come forward saying he was at the store and walked past a gentleman in a van, but, and sort of described he had a baseball hat on, but didn't see anybody else in the van or anything of that nature. So it wasn't until a couple weeks later where they put out a reward for $20,000, and an eyewitness then came forward and said, and his name was Christopher Bivens, he said he was driving by the store and he saw two men. One was a burly, heavyset individual, taller than the victim, putting a girl in a bear hug and forcing her into a van, and that there was another person who he described as possibly older who opened the door and put her in the van. But he didn't stop. He kept going, and he never came forward until the reward money went out. And he was provided a photo of the van, and he said it was the right style but the wrong color, and that was his first statement to police. And he described the men involved as being over 5'11 or 6 foot tall. And then they took him by Richard's van, and again he said he wasn't sure, but they told him to go home and sleep on it, and then call him and let him know in the morning, because he said maybe he was 80% sure. By the time the sheriff's department was done showing Richard's van three or four times to Christopher Bivens, he was then 100% sure that that was the van he saw that day when he was driving by the D&W. That's how Richard became. They identified him as the person with the last purchase, but I would note that Richard called that morning shortly after the kidnapping when he saw a scroll across the television set that the convenience store worker had been as missing. And he called the sheriff's department to identify himself as having been at the store that morning. And it was by 10 o'clock when Sheriff's Deputy Van Patten showed up to Richard Thibodeau's relative's house where they were having an Easter celebration where they took a statement from Richard. And the van was there in the driveway, and he also showed the pack of cigarettes that he had purchased that morning, and he gave a statement. So that's essentially how Richard became on the radar screen of the sheriff's department as a possible suspect in the case.
Yeah, it's not exactly it's not exactly the actions of a kidnapper to call the police and say, hey, I was there.
Right. Now, when is it that you find out, or when is it public knowledge or rumor that Heidi was a undercover informant?
So early on, I was not involved in the case at all, and what I would see is snippets, and I was a young attorney when Heidi was kidnapped. And I remembered reading something about two brothers being suspects, and not much more was revealed other than that. There was rumors because of a report that one of the defense lawyers for Richard Thibodeau, which was Bill Walsh, he saw in a report there was a reference to Heidi Allen being an informant, and that her informant file would be locked up in a safe location within the sheriff's department. And when that was brought to the court's attention during the early stages after the Thibodeau brothers were arrested, they wanted to know, where's this file? We want to know this file. And they were told, and it was publicly put out there, well, the sheriff's deputy who wrote that was mistaken because there is no file and she was never an informant. And that was the information that was relayed to the defense attorneys. So that is where it ended. That she was, they were asserting that that was a mistake, that she wasn't an informant and there was no file. And for all those years, that's what people believed.
Now tell us how she became a drug informant, as you discover.
Go ahead, Lisa.
John, you take that part.
Okay. Yeah, so she was 15 years old, and she was babysitting for her cousin's young daughter, one-year-old daughter, I believe. Heidi took the child with her to a drinking party and left the child in the car. And the police were notified they were investigating her, possibly going to charge her with endangering the welfare of a child. And, you know, possibly facing charges in family court because Heidi was under 16. But instead of that, Heidi's uncle, Russell Sturtz, who was a town judge and knew some of the deputies personally, he was friends with them, he went to the sheriff's office and said, look, instead of having her charged with anything, how about she work as a confidential informant for you in drug cases? And that's what happened. But, of course, that didn't come up back then, that connection. And then that's how she started. She was like 16 when she started. Then she started handing over information about drug dealers in the area.
And you found that this was an unusual age for confidential informants to be employed by the police, wasn't it?
Yes. We talked to other police agencies who said that absolutely they had never, and never would use someone that young. It's just too dangerous. We checked the DEA standard operating procedures on cases, and they said that if a DEA agent ever wanted to use anyone under 18 as an undercover informant, they would have to get special permission, and the parents would have to be involved. And an expert I talked to said that if they ever did, they would be very careful to keep a tight rein on that person so that they could, you know, protect them. And Heidi got none of that. And the Oswego County Sheriff's Office, we looked at their standard operating procedures. They had nothing about protecting underage or other informants, and nothing about how old an informant had to be.
Yeah, in fact, her identity as an informant was exposed because mm-hmm. the handling deputy in charge dropped her file, her Polaroid, her pedigree information, all of that was just dropped in the parking lot, ironically, in the place that she was working as a convenience store cashier. So that information was picked up from the parking lot. The sheriff's department was called, and they retrieved those documents and took them back to the sheriff's department. But at no time was Heidi even told that her identity had been exposed in that parking lot. And it got out, and it became common to those people in the community, particularly in the drug universe, that Heidi was an informant and she was labeled a rat.
Now, you write that, well, police know this. Police know of her role as a police informant, and they obviously know that Van Patten, one of the officers or sheriff deputies, dropped her information in the parking lot where she worked. Now, despite that, how do police continue their investigation and focus on the Thibodeau brothers?
Well, I'd say this, too, just to be clear, that when that information about Heidi had been dropped in the parking lot, she wasn't working there yet. It was almost about a year and a half before she even started working at the convenience store that her information had been exposed. So it just was kind of ironic that it happened in the very parking lot where she would eventually wind up working. In terms of why that information was brushed aside, the best I can gather, first of all, the sheriff's department would never want to be responsible for someone's abduction, particularly if they were the ones that were, you know, careless or reckless with her information. But also, they were of the opinion that they didn't really use her in the capacity as, quote unquote, an informant. So therefore, they weren't really worried about the fact that they exposed her identity, which sort of is beside the point, because people that know about her identity or having been signed up as an informant aren't going to know or care in what capacity they were using her. They're just going to know that she's working with the sheriff's department. It puts her at risk. It was kind of lost on them. They wanted to just kind of brush it under the rug and act as if it was not a big deal, and then not to tell her and or her family members, including, as far as I can tell, they never told her uncle, Russell Sturtz, that they had done that either. So, you know, in all respects, it was just a real reckless thing that they did, and then thereafter failed to take any actions or proactive steps to ensure her safety or to even let her know.
Yeah, and on that point about, you know, they claimed that she never really was an informant, we have interviews of at least three people, her boyfriend, a coworker, and a close friend who said that Heidi was telling them that she was concerned about the informing she was doing. She was concerned about a dangerous guy nearby. She was concerned that the sheriff's office wanted to use her in more serious drug cases. And she expressed a lot of concern about that leading up to the kidnapping. So for them to say that we never used her, well, these people aren't making this up. One of them was the niece of the then undersheriff who later became sheriff, Mo Todd. And she, after the kidnapping, told her uncle about Heidi's concerns about informing. And the sheriff, according to her, just brushed it off, the undersheriff at the time.
Yeah, we also had a witness who we subpoenaed. We had to force into court because Van Patten showed up at his place of employment and was sniffing around asking if he had any information about drug dealing because they had a female informant that was about to make a big bust. And this witness was quoted as saying, and then wham, Heidi went missing.
Yeah, and he said it was in the New Haven area, which is right where the store is, New Haven, New York.
So let's get to how finally Gary and Dick Thibodeau are charged for this kidnapping. Tell us, I know we're fast-forwarding through a lot of information, but how does it get to this point? And tell us a little bit about the actual arrest.
Lisa, you want to do it?
You can, John. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, so Lisa talked about this witness, Chris Bevins, whose testimony whose statements changed a lot over time. But because of him, the sheriff's office really focused on first Dick Thibodeau because they just got him to say basically that was likely the van he saw, that Bevins saw that day. So Dick was driving with his brother-in-law one day, and the cops swarmed over him, guns pointed, and arrested him. Gary, they needed to have two people, and they found out that Dick had a brother because Bevins said he saw two guys. And so they didn't have enough on Gary, so they arrested him. Well, they picked him up on a drug charge out of Massachusetts, which was pending against Gary and his girlfriend, Sharon Rapaza. So they picked him up and had him extradited to Massachusetts, which was a misdemeanor drug charge, which lawyers I've talked to said that's unheard of to be extradited for that. But they got him into a jail in Massachusetts. And when he was released from there, they tracked down a couple of inmates who were near him in jail and got them to say that Gary had made admissions about the kidnapping. And he was then charged with
Heidi's kidnapping. And it wasn't admissions. It was incriminating statements.
Yeah.
It wasn't, they never said that he admitted being involved in the kidnapping. And the interesting part about that was these particular inmates were listening to Gary on the phone with his family trying to find out what was going on because he knew at that point that he was a suspect because it made the papers and they were executing search warrants at his property and they were searching an old furnace with all these ashes and burn particles. So he was getting this information and he was relaying it because they were trying to find out why he was in and he was explaining that he was, targeted as a suspect in this kidnapping. And these two particular inmates thereafter were approached by sheriff's deputies after Gary and Sharon were released on the misdemeanor drug possession charges that they had pending out in Massachusetts. So Gary was already home, Sharon was already home, and the sheriff's deputies tried to find out who was in the facility with Gary. And as John mentioned, they said he made incriminating statements like they won't find her because Heidi's dead or she was killed with a fold-up army-type shovel. which we point out in the book, was the case was happening simultaneous with the O.J. Simpson case and the investigation.
Right.
And it was ironic because in the newspaper clippings, they mention a fold-up Army-type shovel that they were testing for DNA evidence. And
in the O.J. Simpson case, yeah.
In the O.J. Simpson case. So yeah. Then it became this Army fold-up shovel that, you know, Gary said she was hit with or something of that to that, you know, hinting around that that's what was used to kill Heidi Allen. So that's how Gary wound up being arrested. The only evidence that they had, there was nobody that placed Gary at the store. No one identifies Gary ever being there. It was just these two jailhouse informants who made these statements that thereafter provided the sheriff's department with evidence to, you know, if you want to call it that, to arrest Gary and charge him along with Dick.
And as is often the case, like almost always the case, these inmates got a deal on their own pending charges in exchange for their testimony.
Sure.
But, yep. Mm-hmm. And something else, yeah.
Now you take us to
Can I just say one more thing?
Go ahead. Sure.
Well, just Lisa pointed out that Gary was no witness placed in there. And that there was almost no evidence. The sheriff's office also did a complete sweep of the van for anything, looking for anything that would link Heidi to it, you know, hair or blood or whatever, saliva. They could find nothing. So nothing of her in there at all.
Yeah, despite no forensic evidence tying Gary or Dick to this at all, Gary
right.
was the first person to go to trial, and mm-hmm. Dick would go second. Mm-hmm. You read the trial transcripts. If you were in that courtroom at that time, what would you have guessed would have been the outcome based on the proceedings themselves?
Lisa, go ahead.
Well, I would say that they clearly didn't prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt based on the information that was presented to and the evidence presented to the jury. And since the conviction, John actually interviewed one of the jurors who said, well, we figured he must have done something or the sheriffs must know something we don't know because why would they have arrested him? So they voted guilty. I mean, that was sort of the mindset of the jurors thinking, well, something must have happened because,
right.
you know, and then, of course, Christopher Bivens was testifying that he was 100% confident that that was the van he saw, although his testimony was completely incredible when you look at what he originally stated when he called, when he made his first call and how his, you know, his statements kind of evolved. So that was it. That was a sum total of their evidence and the mentality of the jurors at the time and the community outrage that this 18-year-old young woman was kidnapped. You know, that's how they viewed it. And I think that if I were looking at the record, there clearly was not enough evidence to suggest that Gary had anything to do. There was no motive. They could never point to a single reason why Gary and or Richard would have ever been involved in the kidnapping of Heidi Allen.
And I could say I lived in the area that's in Mexico, New York, which is right near New Haven back then. And I remember wasn't covering it as a reporter, but I remember the talk in town wasn't, well, he's going to be, before the verdict came in, he's going to be acquitted. There's just, they haven't presented any evidence. And,
right.
you know, people were just stunned that he was convicted. The one who was most stunned was Gary himself. And there's a picture in the book of his reaction. He throws his head back, his mouth is open. He's just absolutely blown away. And again, this juror I interviewed years later, you know, she even said that the jailhouse snitches really had no effect on them. They just really thought, well, this is the police brought him here. They charged him. He must be guilty, which of course is not the standard at all.
Incredible. You say one.
You know,
of the
but studies
most...
have. I'm sorry. Okay. Apologize. Go ahead. I was just going to mention that.
Go ahead.
Jailhouse informants do increase the likelihood of conviction, even though in the back of the juror's mind, they may not think that they're that credible, but they do, mm-hmm. in fact, rely on the testimony of jailhouse informants, even though I think it cuts against their, you know, what they would really believe and what they would want in terms of evidence. It does, unfortunately, have a greater impact than you would think.
Yeah, and on that point, we interviewed, Lisa and I interviewed a former assistant DA in the Oswego County DA's office who said that the assistant DA who handled this case, Donald Dodd, had a reputation for using jailhouse informants in almost every case. And the prisoners, the inmates, all knew about it. They knew, hey, you want to cut a deal? This guy is the guy to go to. So they had an incentive make up claims that another inmate confessed to them.
You write, too, that one of the important things that happened in this trial was, and in the investigation, was that Chris Bivens' testimony changed as terms of the height description of the suspects that he reported.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that, yeah, and the interesting thing is Richard and Gary are both shorter than Heidi Allen. And mm-hmm. You could not mistake somebody behind Heidi Allen putting her in a bear hug. And the description that Bivens gives is that the suspect was taller than Heidi Allen, which would
Heidi's
completely
discount.
Heidi was
5'11", right? Was,
yeah.
5'11".
Heidi
was
5'11". Mm-hmm.
And he initially put the guys at 6 foot and even over 6 foot.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he was done, he had shrunk them down to like 5'7", which is Gary, and Richard is 5'6", 5'5", nowhere near what he was saying. And that really changed over time with some coaxing from the sheriff's investigators.
Now, with this as well, Dick, his brother, Richard, was supposed to go second. So what happens in his trial? And he has the benefit of not having jailhouse informants as part of the information against him.
Right. He was acquitted. And again, like you said, the big, huge difference was no jailhouse informants. But Dick, once Gary was convicted, he assumed, okay, I'm next. They're going to convict me. You know, he had no hope because he knew that the evidence wasn't there, but this other jury convicted his brother anyway. Dick had been out on bail. When Gary was convicted, the person who posted the bail wanted it back because they thought he might flee. He was arrested again and went to trial, but he was acquitted. And I did talk to his jurors years later, who I think I talked to five or six of them, who were stunned that by the lack of evidence. They were actually very kind of upset about it. You know, how could you charge this guy? And they questioned how the other jury could possibly convict Gary.
And the other note that Richard had a bit of an advantage over Gary is that right before Gary was going to be sentenced, there was information that was leaked to the defense team to disclose the fact that Heidi Allen had kept a couple of diaries, and those diaries hadn't been turned over to the defense. So the defense made a motion for a mistrial and sought sanctions and alleged Brady violations. And the court took the diaries, looked at them, and basically suggested that the Thibodeaux were not ever mentioned in the diary, but it was private information and he wasn't inclined to turn it over and I didn't believe it was Brady. So in Richard's trial, the defense attorney was able to argue to the jury, look, Heidi kept diaries and the Thibodeaux were never mentioned in any of her diaries, as to suggest that she had no contact or issues with the Thibodeaux brothers. So he had that advantage. And second, he also had a report that was the information about Heidi's informant status being exposed and dropped in the parking lot of the DNW. Although he was not given her informant file, and they were downplaying the fact that she was an informant, and they were arguing that she was never used as an informant. But they never turned over the Polaroid picture, the pedigree, or the index card to Richard's attorney either. But he did have a suggestion that would point to somebody else. So Richard had an advantage over Gary as far as, you know, the arguments to be made as to why it wasn't the Thibodeaux's, because as I mentioned before, there was no motive and they couldn't point to a motive that as to why the Thibodeaux's would ever have been involved in kidnapping Heidi Allen.
Mm-hmm. Now you write about Randy Bianco, and she got involved in Gary's case shortly after he was convicted. She handled the appeal.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about Brittany Link and Randy Bianco's efforts.
You want to take that, John?
No, go ahead, please.
Well, she was a young girl who lived across the street from Gary. It was actually kind of kitty corner. It wasn't directly across the street. And several months after Gary was charged, she came forward and said that she remembered waking up, going into the bathroom and going back to bed. And she looked out the window and she said she saw Richard's van in Gary's driveway. And it was shortly
that Easter morning, the
morning that Heidi was kidnapped. She's looking out her bedroom window saying that she saw Richard's van in Gary's driveway. So she testified during the trial, and basically what the DA's office, the prosecutor, was attempting to do is to put Richard at Gary's house to kind of put them together Easter morning, because there was no witness that saw Gary anywhere near the D&W. So after Gary was convicted, Randy had information to suggest that Brittany Link was recanting, and her, along with an investigator, videotaped Brittany Link saying that she thought maybe it was a dream. And whenever she would say that it was a dream, the prosecutor said, well, if I were you, kiddo, I wouldn't say that. And she said that she felt pressured and that she doesn't really know, because she had seen Richard's van over there on different days and it may not have been Easter morning. And that if it were Easter morning, she probably would have gone to get her Easter basket, but she didn't that morning. She went back to bed. So it was a pretty powerful recantation of what she had testified to in court, and it was videotaped. And Randy made a motion, and again, seeking a mistrial, and that motion was denied. And Brittany Link recanted her recantation and said that, you know, Randy pressured her into saying that. But unfortunately, or fortunately for Randy, she videotaped it, and clearly there was no pressuring of any kind whatsoever. But the judge, again, just denied the defense request, and that was the end of it as far as Brittany Link. And then Randy pursued the appeal with the Fourth Department.
And what was
and
the
amazing part of that? I'm sorry, go ahead, Lisa.
Go ahead, John.
No, I just said the amazing part of that not only was that Brittany recanted, but the story that she told about the prosecutor Donald Dodd over and over, kind of hinting at her, you know, let's not talk about thinking that it was a dream or that it was a different day, and you know, he looks really bad in this scenario. But go ahead, Lisa, with what happened after that.
Well, it was just, you know, and then Randy handled the appeal, and the Fourth Department denied the appeal and furthermore added that there was overwhelming evidence against Gary, and that, it, you know, that the diaries weren't Brady material. Well, they didn't even have the diaries, because Donald Dodd the diaries never made it to the appellate court. So nobody read those diaries. But they decided that there was overwhelming evidence, and that was that. And then Randy went to the Court of Appeals seeking leave to appeal, and they refused to hear the case. So she never made it to the Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York. And then she filed a habeas petition, again, arguing that his constitutional rights, Brady violations regarding the diaries, and she was also attacking the statute under which Gary was convicted, that there is a presumption of death for the first-degree kidnapping in New York State. neither one of those arguments prevailed, and after that, his avenues had been exhausted.
Yeah, and Lisa, why don't you talk about Brady material? You mentioned that a couple of times, just real quick. Brady material is...
Let's use this as an opportunity, sorry, Lisa and John, to stop for a second for our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. According to Forbes, gyms, nail salons, hotels, mom-and-pop stores, and more are set to go on an epic hiring spree in the coming months to meet the pent-up demand for all of these services. I was really excited to be able to go see a movie at the theater again. I went to see Stillwater, and I happened to get to see some live stand-up comedy. All of these businesses reopening means that millions of jobs will need to be filled. So where do these businesses turn to fill these roles fast? ZipRecruiter. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, they send your job to over 100 top job sites, giving you access to their network of millions of job seekers. ZipRecruiter's matching technology scans resumes to find qualified candidates for your open roles and proactively presents them to you. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, Lisa and John, we were talking about Randy Bianco losing the appeal, and in the book you are exposing and showing the reader and now our listeners that there was this manipulation by the prosecution and some funny business from the sheriff's department in Oswego there. Let's talk about how you get involved, Lisa, and after that, how, John, you become so inextricably involved.
Okay.
Sure. So in 2013, Randy was in private practice, and I had a vacancy in my office, and she applied for the position as an assistant federal public defender, and I hired her. So she sold her practice because she had been an experienced criminal defense lawyer for many years, mm-hmm. and she had a solid reputation, and she also had a ticket business. So she sold her practice and came to work for me. Probably 6 months into working for me, she came into my office upset because she heard that a woman was trying to reach her and called her old number from her old law office, and it went to the individuals that purchased her business. And had information regarding Gary's case that would exonerate him. And apparently, well, what happened was that information was relayed to the DA's office, and at the time the DA was Greg Oakes. And they bypassed Randy, and she didn't know about it. She just happened to, it just happened to come up in conversation that this woman had been looking for. When Randy found that out, she tried to get a hold of Greg Oakes, who then refused to give her the information. And he said, the woman doesn't want to talk to you. And Randy was outraged because the woman tried to reach her, so why wouldn't she want to talk to her? But in any event, he agreed to follow up on this new information and keep her in the loop. So meanwhile, I didn't really have much to do with what was going on. She would occasionally come in and kind of update me as to what she was being told by the DA's office. And then one day she got a packet of information, a lot of CDs, and came to the office and they said, we're not doing anything with the new information. It's not credible. And the witness who came forward is incredible. So Randy had a lot of CDs to listen to, so my investigator at the time thought he would listen to them when he had a minute, and that's when he heard the monitored call and listened to an interrogation of a woman who was involved in this monitored call, making admissions about what she knew regarding Heidi's disappearance, and then Randy was up in arms and came back to me, and I didn't know how I could get involved in the case because it was a state case and we were federal defenders. So we tried to recruit lawyers to take the case. It was an enormous undertaking, and it would be very difficult to do because it would essentially be a pro bono situation. There, Gary was broke. He's been in prison all these years. He didn't have a nickel to his name. So, you know, we lingered, and my investigator and I had tried to do some different things that he had suggested to maybe kind of, you know, really get the ball rolling so that maybe we could get the interest of a local attorney and maybe somebody would take on the cause. And, of course, the Innocence Project wouldn't take it because we didn't have – there's no body, right, no DNA. So it was just going to be a lot of investigation, a lot of work, and a huge undertaking. So we finally – my investigator suggested, you know, why don't you call the paper and let them expose this? And we thought about it for a while, and I was a little reluctant initially. But then when I realized here we have this innocent man sitting in prison, and I was so blown away by what I was listening to and what I was seeing that I just couldn't sit back and not do anything with this information. Right. So I passed it along to John. And John right away, you know, and he'll tell you what he was doing, but, you know, he confronted one of the jailhouse informants off the bat. And then John learned about Dick having his case file in a shed. So my investigator and I ran over to the house and we grabbed all these boxes because I wanted to go through his file and see if there was anything in there that wasn't in Gary's file. That's where I discovered the reports regarding Heidi's informant information being dropped in the parking lot. When I asked Randy whether she'd ever heard of such a thing, she was blown away because she had never heard about Heidi being an informant or that her information had been dropped in the parking lot, only that, you know, they denied she was ever an informant. So that's when I went to my chief judge and asked whether I could be appointed in the case because I believe constitutional violations had taken place that weren't previously brought up because they weren't known when Randy filed the original habeas petition in family or federal court regarding the diaries and the attack on the actual statute. So he said yes, and I said, well, I have to go into state court likely because we have to exhaust all of the state court remedies before we can bring it to federal court. And the chief judge appointed me and allowed me to get involved in this case. So meanwhile, John's doing his investigation, and now I'm on the case, and we're doing our investigation, and that's kind of how it all sort of began.
Yeah, so I'll tell you how I got involved. Like I said, Lisa was a source of mine, and I always bug her for, you know, good cases, and then one day she called me and said, I do have one that this was probably early 2014, you know, months after Randy had heard about this new witness. And Lisa told me then, okay, it involves Heidi Allen. And I got my ears perked up. And it took me another couple of months to get her to say, she called me and said, just, I can't tell you what it is. I just want you to come over to my office and listen to something. So, of course, I ran right over, and Lisa played for me the recording of the phone call between the new witness who came forward, Tanya Priest, and this woman, Jennifer Westcott. The sheriff's office had set up the call. They were monitoring it, and Tanya was working with them, but Jennifer didn't know she was talking to anyone but this friend. And I sat there and listened to Jennifer Westcott say things like, they wouldn't even bring her, Heidi, in the house. They made her sit in the van. She said, this thing has been in my head all these years. There's no way I would ever tell the investigators because I don't want to open that can of worms. And I was, you know, flabbergasted. This was the first time that someone, to my knowledge, ever said something that they knew what happened to Heidi after she was kidnapped.
Right.
And then Lisa also said, now you got to watch this interrogation video. The sheriff's investigator had this Jennifer Westcott after the call. They called her in to interrogate her about it. And this investigator, Petrosky, did a good job of getting Jennifer to basically, she absolutely lied about that phone call. So she didn't know it was recorded. Right. Then he confronts her and says, well, this is what you said. And she is blown away. She's taken aback. She thinks she's in big trouble because they have the recording. But at the end of that video, Petrovsky just says, "Nope, no problem. You're not going to be in trouble. We're going to squash this," is what he said. So I knew two things at that point. One is that the Thibodeaus were absolutely innocent, and that the sheriff's office was covering it up. So I was just ready to go. And then I started my investigation. Lisa did hers. We would talk back and forth, not share everything, but we're sort of working together and apart after that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You went to your editor, John, at the Post Standard, and at first you write that he assigned you to do this. He said, yeah, go ahead, but cover these other cases as well. And
yeah,
so you had
right.
no idea how you could really focus on this properly. And then a week later, your editor came to you and said, look, this is important. Don't do anything else. Go for this.
Yeah, which was surprising because this was at a time when the whole in newspaper mm-hmm. business was in upheaval, and they were just trying to get quick stories up as fast as possible, whereas back 2 or 3 years earlier, they would have quickly taken me off everything else but this. So, yes, they mm-hmm. did give me free rein to just do nothing but this, and it was a full-time job from there. Yeah.
So, Lisa, what do you do, and John, what do you do in terms of this information that you now have? This new information, Lisa, do you think it's enough mm-hmm. to be able to get another hearing, and how do you proceed with that?
Yep. So I thought the phone call in and of itself, in combination with the interrogation and Jennifer Westcott's obvious lies throughout the questioning by Petrovsky, would be plenty to get Gary a new trial because there wasn't any evidence against him to begin with. And now we have mm-hmm. somebody admitting that, you know, they brought Heidi over to her house but made her sit in the van, and it wasn't the Thibodeaus. It was these three new suspects that were mentioned in this phone call. So at that point, I felt like we have enough. We were then trying to find out if we could find a cabin in the woods based on the statement by the witness who had come forward, who
right.
initiated or who they monitored the call with Jennifer Westcott. So we were spending a lot of time trying to figure out where there was a cabin in the woods and whether or not we could find out, you know, if her, in fact, Heidi's remains were out there, because that would really clinch it for us. So we were trying to do that. And it just so happened that when John published his first story, a witness called and said, oh, there is another cabin. My son built a cabin years back, and it's right across the street on Rice Road, which is exactly where the witness had come forward and said Westcott was staying, and there was a cabin. So it was sort of matching up with where this Tanya Priest, when she came forward, suggested that Steen, one of the three new suspects, said Heidi had been taken to and chopped up and put under floorboards. So, John, you can kind of take over from there, and that's where, you know, we kind of really started coming together trying to find out if we could get, you know, find Heidi's remains.
Yeah, so Lisa's investigator, Dick Hallman, and I went together. We decided it would work better to try to find this cabin. And we interviewed people in the neighborhood who pointed us to one cabin, and then there was nothing. We dug it up. There was nothing there. And that's when I published my first story about the new evidence. Mm-hmm. And like Lisa said, I got a text, I think, from this woman who's talked about this other cabin. So we agreed. We quickly went out there, Hallman and I did, and we got to that cabin and found it was completely disheveled, dug up. Someone had been there recently, which we mm-hmm. just freaked out. We thought, okay, because of the story that I published, maybe the kidnappers came out here and got what they wanted, got maybe possibly remains or something. That didn't turn out to be the reason it was dug up, but So right at the scene, we called the police and then Greg Oakes, the DA, to get out there because we didn't want to be accused of doing anything improper. So Oakes came out. It took a long time for him, I think, to convince the sheriff's office to come out because it was based on the newspaper and the public defender's office information. They finally came out, and they dug around, and they used a state police cadaver dog, which alerted to the scent of human remains near the cabin, right next to the cabin. But they sifted through the dirt, didn't find anything, and just they left. I will say that what they left behind were things like a mattress and some carpets and, you know, wood that could have, you know, had Heidi's blood on them. Because it would have been a bloody scene, and they just left them, never tested them. And they never took soil samples. This is key, that they never brought anything back to test for chemicals that would have, you know, would have been in the soil from Heidi's body. Just left it. They did the most basic, rudimentary search and found nothing and said, okay, we're done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on that note, you know, the fresh digging around, we obviously know who was involved with that, but whether someone was there digging around prior to that, for example,
right. Mm-hmm.
Westcott was interviewed in 20, her original interview was in 2014. So 2013, excuse me. So when she was interviewed in 2013, she told one of the new suspects, the boyfriend that she was with at the time Heidi was abducted, that, you know, she had been interviewed about the Heidi Allen case. I mean, she let them know that. So there was no effort on the part of the sheriff's department to search for a cabin based on the information. And then Westcott has knowledge that there's this new information that someone's coming forward. And, you know, so we don't know what happened between her interview in March of 2013 and fast forward to August of 2014, when the sheriff's department started doing this dig at Rice Road at the cabin. And again, and as John mentioned, they didn't do any sort of soil sample testing where the dog alerted, which would have been important because the gases and the decomposition of the human body would have certainly revealed whether or not, and more accurate, before they started digging around and sifting through all the dirt and diluting it, whether in fact there were human remains there. But again, the dog alerted to it, so...
Let's use this as an opportunity, John, Lisa, just for a second to stop for these messages. Now, we talked about that police should have done things like tested that soil for human remains. But what we haven't talked about is the general conversation between all of these people that you get to talk in bits and pieces, and especially from the transcripts from Westcott, talking about that she's still afraid of these people. Let's talk about mm-hmm. James Steen, Roger Breckenridge, and Michael Borrier. And as you write in the book, Michael Borrier was the guy that would go in to the D&W and get Heidi to make him a BLT every time she was on shift. So let's talk about James Steen and Roger Breckenridge and Michael Borrier.
Okay. So those were the three named new suspects based on the statement by Tanya Priest, who came forward. And taking Steen first, he was the one that was spouting off to Tanya Priest that he knew what happened to Heidi Allen, that she was a rat, and that they kidnapped her using Michael Bohr's van, and that they chopped her up, put her under the floorboards of a cabin, and, you know, he'll never go to prison or do a day in prison for what they did to Heidi Allen. And he so much as bragged about it to other people. It wasn't just Tanya Priest. There were individuals that were disconnected to Tanya Priest where he made similar claims that Heidi was a rat and that he was taking care of her because you know, she or even disposing of her body on behalf of a motorcycle gang. He had mentioned to one of our witnesses that we called. But important to note is that when he was making these statements about Heidi Allen, he was incensed that his estranged wife and he were having marital problems and he was threatening to kill her. And right. As part of that, he was basically bragging that he, you know, don't think that I won't because I've already done it, you know. And in fact, he did kill his estranged wife along with his cousin because they were seeing each other. And he went, and while his young child was walking around in a diaper at the place where the mother was staying, he execution style shot and killed both of them. And he was holed up in this apartment while the sheriff's department was negotiating him to come out and turn himself in. And John, you might want to take over on that part of the James Steen thing, what you discovered during the investigation.
Yeah, and that was in 2010, right, Lisa? 2010.
Yes, that was September of 2010. Yep.
September 2010. So when I got involved in this, in the Heidi case, I filed a Freedom of Information request with the DA's office and the sheriff's office for everything on Steen's murder, the 20 double murders that he committed in 2010, including all the texts and phone calls he made over a period, and the jail calls, the recordings of him talking. I was looking through the texts that came in on his phone, and I noticed one that was minutes after he killed his estranged wife and cousin, and it said, "Heidi? ?
Wow.
And it just jumped out at me, like, why? What could that be about? And we would find out later that came from the phone of a guy he was drinking with the night before. And there's no other Heidi in Steen's life. He testified to that. There's no other Heidi it could possibly be. But the guy who sent it was belligerent with me and the sheriff's office who interviewed him, that he didn't know what it was about. But that is an unanswered question. What did that mean? And this is the guy who sent it, is the guy who Steen borrowed his truck the night before and drove the truck to the scene where he committed the murders.
Yes, Steen drove this guy's truck, and this guy wakes up in the morning and sees this crime scene tape and his truck, like, right in the middle of all the media coverage.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
what prompted him to shoot the text. He tried calling Steen because you see a missed call.
Right,
and then
right.
that's when the text message was sent. But during the course of the hearing, they could not explain it. And then they were denying having sent it and having received it or no memory of it, et cetera. So there was never
right.
any explanation provided with regard to what that meant and why he sent it. But it's obvious.
Right. So then that's Steen. And then Breckenridge was a guy who had known Steen and done drugs with him for years, had all kinds of criminal history, and he would hang out with Steen and Borer, and he was dating this Jennifer Westcott, who was in that call, was involved in that phone call.
Right.
And he's kind of a low life. So then,
what was their connection? What was their connection to the scrapyard?
Oh, good point. Yes, they mm-hmm. both, all three would bring scrap cars to the to a scrapyard in Volney, New York, that was owned by the Murtaugh family. So they were all involved in that. That'd be Breckenridge, Steen, and Borer. So they knew each other that way, and that had been going on for years.
Steen did a lot of the transport of the crushed cars to different scrap yards
mm-hmm.
in Canada, and Roger kind of hung around at the scrap yard and worked there, and Borer learned that scrapping steel or cars was profitable and started, you know, kind of nosing around the scrap yard. We also had information to suggest that there were a lot of drugs that were flowing in and around the scrapyard in Volney.
Yep.
You endeavored to talk to all of these people, John.
Yes.
But who do you target, and who do you think is the best bet out of the three to be able to give you information? And how do you plan on approaching him?
Well, so when I started out, I thought, well, Steen, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. So I thought, here's a guy, he has nothing to lose. So I wrote him a couple letters trying to get him to, you know, to do the right thing. You know, you've made some bad decisions in your life, but you can do one good thing. And he wrote back and denied anything and everything and called Tanya Priest a big liar. And so I got nowhere with him. And then I tracked down Michael Borer at he was living in an RV on Allen Road, you know, kind of ironically, same last name as the victim here. Mm-hmm. And I confronted him. I recorded the interview. When I eventually told him, look, someone said you were involved in this. You were part of this kidnapping. He denied it up and down, and he was upset with me for asking, and he did acknowledge that he knew that Heidi's informant card had been dropped in the parking lot. And I said, well, how did you know that? It wasn't public. He said, oh, it came out in the media. I said, no, it didn't. It absolutely did not. And he said, oh, well, it came out in the trial then. And I said, no, I've looked at the transcript, Gary's transcript. It's not in there. And then he said, oh, word of mouth then. So he admitted he heard word of mouth back then that Heidi was an informant. And this is the guy who was dealing drugs. Lisa confronted him after that, and she can tell you about that. She did it by herself.
So, we knew that Michael Borer had talked to investigators after Westcott's phone monitored call with Priest, and I listened to the audio of that, and I couldn't believe some of the information that he was giving and the lack of follow-up. He said that the reason he could not have been involved in the kidnapping of Heidi Allen is because the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, and he has a daughter the same age as Heidi, and he couldn't believe that an 18-year-old young girl would come missing. And, oh, by the way, I wrote a lot about the case, and I collected a lot of articles, and he takes the sheriff's deputies over to his trailer and has this box of information that he collected and a lot of writings that he created about the case and theories that he wrote, and gave that to the sheriff's deputies. So they were chalking him up to a crazy person, that he's mentally ill, that he injected himself into the investigation. He was calling in false leads, and obviously, as you mentioned before, he was in the store almost daily getting BLT sandwiches. So I decided it was time to confront him. I didn't really know. I thought maybe Steen was the mastermind, maybe Borer, they were using him, you know, as the driver because he had a van. So I decided to meet up with him, and actually he was willing to meet up with me, and the first thing I said to him was, you know, well, I think you were involved in this. I think you did it. And then he's like, you do? Well, maybe I shouldn't be talking to you then. But he then sat down and kind of talked to me for 3 hours, and he told me his background was off limits. He was not going to talk about anything involving his family or his personal life, but he would provide me with all these various theories about what he thought happened. And at one point he made a statement, and I looked at him and I had this kind of look on my face, like a smirk, and he basically told me to wipe that smirk off my face, and it really kind of made the hair on the back of my neck stand up, and I thought, well, I should probably end this, because we were in the back of a off-track betting place that was not exactly, I guess, the best place to meet somebody like him. So we parted ways, and I was convinced that there was so much more to this guy, because none of this made sense. And I made a letter request to the court seeking requesting that the DA's office and or sheriff's department further investigate Michael Borer. I mean, does he have a daughter Heidi Allen's age? What's his background? Because we ran a check and we didn't get much from a criminal history standpoint in New York. So we got feedback from the judge who said, if you want to do the investigation on Michael Borer, you can do it at your own expense. They're not required to do it. And by the way, the DA's office just thought he was a crazy person. Mm-hmm. So I noticed that his Social Security number had been issued out of Wisconsin. So I asked Dick Common, my investigator, to run a criminal history check to see whether there were any convictions that Michael Bohr might have out of Wisconsin. And this is right before we were going to be having this evidentiary hearing to see if Gary could get a new trial based on the new evidence. Mm-hmm. And it came back that, sure enough, he had a conviction for unlawful imprisonment and another disorderly conduct. But we couldn't figure out what it was, because when we were calling the police department that had made the arrest, they said that they don't have the records anymore. They were destroyed. And then we called the court, and they said they couldn't find anything on it. So I was sort of left wondering what this was all about, and I knew he would. I kind of wanted to confront him about this and try to explain to me what this was about. I also learned, I did a lot of digging into his family background, that, you know, he and his brother were adopted. He had an adopted brother, and that he did have, you know, siblings and other people around the country, and I was trying to reach out and make contact with them. And I also learned he had an ex-wife, and he did have two daughters. So we went to court, and I'm confronting him with the information about the conviction, and the court would not allow me to ask any questions about it. And then he did allow me to say, ask him whether he had any past violent history against women, to which he answered, no. I never hit any woman or punched any woman, was his answer. The judge would not allow me to explore or to ask him any other questions about his background or personal history. By the time the hearing was adjourned for a couple of weeks, I was incensed because I felt like there was so much more and I couldn't figure out what actually had happened. And that's when kind of we blew open Michael Bohr. I demanded that we get a hold of the court and find out. There had to be records. There had to be some sort of record about what actually happened. And then we saw that he had a brother who had also been charged, which is why the court said they couldn't find the records of the unlawful imprisonment. They were looking, it was under the wrong name, John Bohr. Mm. So right. We located John Bohr in Erie, Pennsylvania. We made a beeline out there. We found him at a residential sort of nursing home setting, and he proceeded to tell me the most unbelievable account of what had taken place. I was shocked. They had followed a woman home from her place of employment after she went out to grab a bite to eat. It was 1:00 in the morning. They boxed her in her apartment complex. Michael got out of the car, went up behind her and grabbed her and tried stuffing her in the back seat of this yellow Mustang he was driving while John Bohr was reaching in the back trying to grab her in. She provided enough leverage on the top of the car where she was able to break loose because they realized people in the apartment building were kind of, the victim was making enough noise to where lights were starting to go on. So they let her go. She ran in, told her brother, who happened to be at her apartment. They called the police, and they were able to catch them and arrest them. So for that, they pled guilty to a misdemeanor and received a sentence of 3 years probation. Yeah. And apparently before that, the disorderly conduct involved another woman that Michael Bohr was following home from work and tried to ram her off the road, and he got out of his car when she was at a stop sign and started pounding on the windows, and she was so hysterical, she drove right to a police station where there was a security officer outside the building, and he was able to see Michael Bohr circle back around and kind of look, and they were able to identify him and arrest him, and in that case, he pled to a disorderly conduct. So That was the basis for those two convictions. So we provide that information to the district attorney's office thinking, well, this has just blown the whole case open. I mean, this has got to be something, you know, in light of the admissions, the false leads that he called in, all the writings that he made. You know, he made admissions to somebody at a tavern about how distraught he's been all these years holding us in and knowing what happened to
Heidi. About Heidi.
Yeah, about Heidi. Yeah. So we, you know, I was really convinced that, wow, this is it. This is, you know, they were so wrong about him and they did no investigation and here we have all this stuff. So of course, that wasn't exactly what happened.
Tell them what Greg Oakes said, Lisa.
Said he had a pit in his stomach, and he wasn't sure what he was going to do, and he wanted to do the right thing. And if Gary's innocent, he wants to be the first one to make sure he doesn't do another day in prison. But then when I flew in the victim to testify during the hearing about what had happened, he objected, said it wasn't relevant, and that it would be like saying anyone, you know, who commits a burglary thereafter would be a suspect in any other burglary. And
right.
My response to that was kidnappings of this nature, this brazen, emboldened sort of attack where you're just grabbing a woman and stuffing her in the back seat of your car is not something
right.
that's very common at all, and it's very unusual in the manner in which they were, the eyewitnesses were even talking about how this brute force was used to stuff Heidi in the back of the van. You know, I don't know how, in the coincidence that he lives a half a mile down the road and was in the store every day and knew that she was an informant and, by the way, was involved in slinging drugs in the Oswego County area, all of those things, and calling in, of course, the false leads. It wasn't just in a vacuum, oh, geez, he tried to kidnap or abduct a woman one time. There was more to it than that. And then, of course, after we knew something else happened in Beacon, he was never arrested for it, but he was a suspect, and the prosecution found that a woman who had been beaten over the head in a duplex that he owned, and he happened to, quote, discover her, identified him as being the last person there and wanting to rape her before she went unconscious and didn't remember who had hit her in the head. And she was left, they called it a DOA initially because they didn't think she was going to survive. She went through 7 brain surgeries.
Wow.
But to this day, she, you know, the last person she really, she was running from Michael Bohr throughout the apartment, and that's the last thing she remembers. So.
Right.
That's pretty much the background of the 3 new suspects and the information that we were, you know, trying to elicit throughout the course of the hearing.
In 2017, Lisa, you were trying to petition New York's highest court, and you said
mm-hmm.
at this time that Gary was on borrowed time. So tell us, you had
mm-hmm.
met Gary and visited with Gary and told him about the new evidence and tell us about the state of Gary and what he was like mm-hmm. living in there for 20 years and more about this mm-hmm. highest court preparation.
Sure. So when I first met Gary, I didn't realize how frail he would look because I hadn't met him before. I'd seen pictures from the media accounts, but I had never met him. And by the time I met him, he was really thin. And it winded him just to walk across the yard to get to the attorney visitation room. He had big old glasses on, and he was, you know, really struggling to breathe, but very happy that somebody took an interest in his case after all these years, because by then he had given up all hope that he would ever be released. So he was just really hoping to die because it was the only way he believed he would be free. And as time went on, I got to know him rather well, and he would write letters, and he was very funny and sarcastic and had a different sense of humor, but he was very likable and very funny considering he was in prison for something he didn't do all those years. He was not a bitter person. He said, by the time I met him, he had already gotten over that part of it and just accepted his fate and realized that, you know, there's nothing more he can do. So he was just trying to make the best of it. And he had been working in the tailor shop. So as the case was progressing through the court system and he attended the hearing, he was seeing what was going on and the rulings that we were getting and the denial of being able to call witnesses. And at some point it reached a point where he felt so discouraged and it was just going to happen all over again. And he didn't want to be at the hearing anymore. He had, you know, requested that I not make him sit through it. It was hard for him because he was frail. He had a bad back. He had plates in his ankle. And the first day of the hearing, the sheriff's made him go down the set of stairs with his leg shackles on and his arms cuffed, his hands cuffed together. And he lost his footing, tripped and fell down the stairs. And why they didn't allow him to go down the elevator is beyond me, but they didn't. And he really hurt his back when he fell. So he was very uncomfortable, and it was a shame. But as we were going through the appeal process, every time I would go visit Gary and give him an update, he was increasingly looking more frail, and his breathing was becoming more labored. And at one point, I just looked at him, and I was shocked at how fast he was declining. I could see that he was on borrowed time, and I felt like it was a race against time to actually give him news that he had been exonerated or that it was at least going to be granted a new trial. So, I was becoming more and more concerned that he wasn't going to make it through the whole process. And then when we lost, we had at the appellate division, and we had one judge who dissented but wrote a amazing dissenting opinion. It really kind of refueled me, okay, here we have a judge who believes in Gary's innocence. He's somebody who followed what the new evidence meant, and he believes Gary deserves a new trial. So here we go. We're going to go to the Court of Appeals. And a lot of what I was being told is, hey, it's almost impossible to get your case heard at that level. And I wasn't going to hear of that. We were just going to put our best foot forward, and we got the news. The Court of Appeals has decided to hear the case. We were beyond thrilled because I thought, okay, this is it. You know, this is a level where we're going to get relief for Gary. And then we get the decision back 4-3. We lost. But again, wow. The dissent was an amazing decision, and much longer and much more detailed and much more analysis than the majority opinion. But I had to go to Gary and tell him that we have one more avenue to pursue at the Court of Appeals, and then it's into federal court, which is where we were originally thinking we would have to go anyway. But this process took so long. You know, here we start in 2014, now we're at 2017, and now we're 2018. And Gary is just skeletal by then and not even able to breathe on his own. So it was sad and frustrating and disheartening. And, I just had wanted Gary to be able to hang on as long as possible, but I just knew that there was absolutely no chance that he could make it through a federal habeas petition.
Tell us about his passing, and we hadn't mentioned his wife when she passed away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sharon passed away when she was undergoing surgery while Gary was in prison shortly after they got married. They weren't married very long. They did get married after Gary had been convicted. Gary, it was a 96, I believe, John, if I'm not
mistaken. Yes, I think that's right.
And, he had to learn about Sharon passing while he was in prison. And then by the time we were with the Court of Appeals, I had hired John as an investigator for our office at the Federal Public Defender's Office because he was seeking a buyout because he had been at the paper for more than 30 years, like he mentioned, and he was looking to... You know, it was time for him, he felt, and we had an opening. So together we would frequently go keep Gary updated about his case, and we were with him day before he passed, and it was really very hard. It was really hard to watch. We were there with his brother, Richard. He went, and then his niece was also there. And, it was just really heartbreaking and sad, and I felt like I let him down because I had kept promising him that we would win and we were going to keep going. And I just felt like I promised him something I wasn't able to deliver on. And it really tore me up, which is why we wanted to capture all of the events of what took place in the best possible way, in all in one place, for people to understand what happened throughout this process and how the system failed Gary.
Yeah, and can I just say there were a lot of moments throughout this investigation that I thought, okay, this is it. One was mm-hmm. when Lisa brought two more cadaver dogs back with their handlers, and those two dogs, expertly trained, also alerted for the scent of human remains. The other time that I thought this is huge, it's going to push us over the edge, was during the dig that the sheriff's office did of the cabin site. Jennifer Westcott texted to a friend that I don't care what people are saying, I'm not saying nothing about it. I will not be the next one dead in a box in the woods. And that's her writing to someone thinking the whole world isn't watching. But there are a lot of moments like that. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. the people on the other side, the prosecutor, Greg Oakes, just did not do the right thing.
Yeah. It's an incredible tale. I want to thank you so much, Lisa Peebles and John O'Brien, for coming on and talking about Scrapped, Justice, and a Team Informant. For those that might want to take a look at this, I know this is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but is there a Facebook page or a website or anything they might take a look at this further?
Yeah, we have an author's page on Facebook. It's called Scrapped, Justice, and a Team Informant. And our publisher is Black Rose Writing. You can get the book there, or obviously on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other places. And if people read it and they want to write a review, we'd be happy. We'd love to hear from people. So.
Absolutely. Again, thank you so much, Lisa Peebles and John O'Brien, for this Scrapped, Justice, and a Team Informant. This is a remarkable expose and an extraordinary book. Thank you so much for this interview.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Both have a great evening.
You too.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.